Reform to order, and welcome everyone to Hearing Room C on this balmy, warm afternoon in sunny Salem, Oregon. I'd also like to thank my co-chair for giving me the privilege of chairing this first meeting. We will be rotating as we go through this. And I would also most assuredly like to thank all of the House members that have joined us and will continue to join us throughout these proceedings. We thought we were going to be short of chairs, so I most appreciate Mitch Greenlick for bringing his own. Thank you, Mitch. First order of business is an organizational meeting, so I will close the introductory remarks, open a special organizational meeting for the Senate Special Committee on Health Care Reform. I believe committee rules have been distributed to all committee members, and I'm quite certain you have read them thoroughly, and since most of you have served in this process many times, they're the same rules we've been operating under for a number of years. I see Representative or Senator Cruz is desperate to speak.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of rules.
Senator Cruz has moved the adoption of rules. Committee rules. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. We will continue in the organizational meeting. I think it's appropriate that every member of the dais be able to introduce themselves, and let's just start with Mr. Cannon, Representative Cannon.
Hi, I am Representative Ben Cannon, representing District 46, which contains southeast and northeast Portland, clustered around the Mount Tabor area. I'm a teacher on leave of absence from my ordinary job, which is teaching middle school to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders in Tualatin, Oregon. So very glad to be here and look forward to working with our Senate colleagues on some important and certainly timely health care reform.
Thank you, Ben. Chair Greenlick.
Thank you, sir. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, representing House District 33, Northwest Portland, all the way west to North Plains. I'm delighted to be here. I really thank you for the invitation. I chair the House Committee on Health Care and its subcommittee on health care access. Representative Cannon is vice chair of that. I guess Representative Richardson is the other vice chair. Where is he?
His chair's there.
Over there. Yeah, he's at another committee meeting right now. He'll be back in about 45 minutes.
This is the issue this committee is dealing with is about as important to me personally as any of the issues we're dealing with, many of the tough issues we're dealing with in this session. I was really delighted when the co-chairs invited me to join with them in the interim on the special committee. I have made our subcommittee on healthcare access available to be joining whenever it makes sense, and to hold formal joint meetings whenever it makes sense, or to be your guest, and we'll see how that works out as we go along. Thank you very much.
I would also like to add that Mitch was instrumental in facilitating the discussions that allowed the House members to be here, and both Alan and I, as well as the entire committee, as well as the House members, think this is a vital component to legislation that we will produce out of this committee. So thank you very much for your efforts, Mitch. Dr. Jeff.
Hi. I'm Jeff Cruz, State Senator, District 1, which is Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Coosa-Curry counties, part or all of that mix. I'm very glad to be here. We have dabbled in these issues before, I believe, gentlemen. And it's good to see my good friend Mitch is back with us. And I look forward to a very robust discussion. as we go through the time here, and I'm also wondering when we start meeting upstairs at 7 o'clock for our wood groups, but I'm sure that's going to happen. So that's one thing about this group is if we had any free time in the building, it will now be gone. So
that's exactly right. And this just must be said, from the day Jeff Cruz stepped foot into this building 10 years ago, he instantly became one of the healthcare warriors. So thank you for being here, Jeff, very sincerely. He's been here the whole time. William?
Senator Elmore said District 6, which is part of Linn and Lane County. I live in Springfield. It's a rural-urban divide district, and I'm very pleased to be here. We don't have enough time either this evening or during the week, or, you know, we're going to have to meet additional times. And I want to say a word about Mr. Cruz, Senator Cruz. Everything I've learned about health care, I've learned from Jeff Cruz, most of which I'm trying to forget. But I learned it first at the feet of Jeff Cruz.
Thank you, Bill. Jim, why don't you take it from that end? Ron, excuse me.
That's all right.
I knew I was going to learn that name wrong. Jim Ron, go ahead.
Jim Ron, is that my new nickname? I'm Representative Ron Maurer, District 3, which is most of Josephine County. Gordon Anderson held a seat prior to my election, and I am very glad to be part of this committee and invitation to this joint, or actually the Senate committee, and look forward to the debate. Healthcare has been part of my life for the last 20 years, and I am looking forward to it. Thank you.
I'm Senator Lori Moniz-Anderson, and I represent District 25, which is Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. I'm very happy to be a part of this group and have been on the interim. Reform is needed, and when I go door knocking, that's what I hear at the door. I am a nurse by profession, and I'm happy to be here.
Senator Frank Morse, representing the Albany, Corvallis areas of the state. My background is a retired businessman. I've had quite a number of years in a governance role in Samaritan Health Services, a regional provider in the Mid-Willamette Valley and the central portion of the coast.
And a member of the Senate Commission.
A vital man. I assume most of you know me. I'm Dr. Alan Bates. I'm a physician in Southern Oregon. I have a private practice there. I still practice 3 days a week, 2 days a week when I'm in session. And I always have been, always will be a physician first in these proceedings, and I guess I should make that very clear. I'm also a senator from Southern Oregon, representing Medford and Ashland. Along with Ben, I co-chair the Senate Access Committee through the interim, a lot of which work we'll be looking at here in the next few weeks. Ben and I will both have some opening remarks later on, so I'll hold them until then, but I want to thank the audience for showing up. It's going to be a lot of evening work here, a lot of 5 o'clock meetings, probably 2 or 3 a week through April, maybe longer. Appreciate your attention and your interest and your input. Especially want to thank the House members for coming over. This is going to be a complex issue we're going to deal with, and the bill that comes out of this will be a complex issue, a complex bill itself. Having your input at this point is really going to be important. We've done this once before in a similar situation, and sending a bill like this back and forth gets to be very confusing. And the bill can change so rapidly, so quickly, you don't hardly recognize it when you're through. We don't want that to happen again, so I appreciate your participation. It's going to be some long days and some long nights. Senator Cruz has been there before, one of the original three amigos, and we're going to go there again.
You don't have to get nasty about it.
And you're going with it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And I'm Senator Ben Westland, District 27, which is functionally Deschutes County. You know, I learned a long time ago that every bill is important to someone, but very few are important to everyone. This committee's charge and the opportunity before us is that we can produce we will produce legislation that will be desperately and vitally important to every Oregonian. Nothing short of achieving that lofty goal will be acceptable to me, to my co-chair, and the committee members. This has not been done in a vacuum in the failing nature of our healthcare system. Is no secret to any of you in this room or anyone in Oregon, for that matter, most people in Oregon. And there are several initiatives that are underway. And while I also learned long ago that the words that I say from this diet aren't as important as what the Archimedes Group and the Oregon Health Policy Commission, the Oregon Business Council, and certainly the people that testify from the Senate Commission say at that dais. Those are the most important words of all of the stakeholders. But the very most important words are the words spoken by the individual citizens that are so impacted by this healthcare crisis. We cannot sustain what we are currently doing, and in good conscience or good economic practice, continue the current system. No one in this room disagrees with that. The question before this committee is to operate in a fashion that will allow all ideas, all proposals to be equally weighed, evaluated, and then this committee as a whole produce the best work product for Oregon. You know, it's not just that it's the right thing to do. It's not that it's a good thing to do. It's the smart thing to do. And in the process, improve the quality of life of every Oregonian. There are certain healthcare bills that are already underway. And we have with us at the dais this evening Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, who is, you know, so committed, so passionate, and the primary driver of the Children's Health Plan. She and the governor have worked tirelessly in crafting this very fine piece of legislation. This needs to be passed soon, needs to be passed first, and it needs to be passed soon. So anything that we at this dais or you in the audience can do to help pass the Healthy Kids Plan is the first step. But that is just the first, much needed, but first step. We must continue that work. And I know Lori's committed to that. At this dais, and Lori, we all commend you for your countless hours that you put into the Healthy Kids Plan. Thank you so very much. There's much work to do, and like I said when I first started this, I understand that my words aren't the most important words. So I think with that, we'll really get this show on the road. I can't tell you what a long time coming this has been. We are thrilled to be here under these circumstances with this charge and the opportunity before us. So before we close the organizational meeting, let me turn it over to my co-chair and to say a few words as well.
Thank you, Ben. You know, I looked forward to this day for the last 16 months with some trepidation and some excitement, and I'm glad it's finally here. We are starting down a course that I think will lead us to a partial or even a complete resolution of a crisis facing our country. This is about life and death. We can talk about all kinds of systems and the cost and where we rank and where we don't rank. But when you're facing a cancer or you're facing another life and death situation, it becomes very individualized and very personal. If you're caught in a system, it doesn't get you the care you need to save your life. All the things you think about otherwise go away. You don't worry about your mortgage payment. You don't worry about your job. You worry about surviving and living. At least two people on this panel have been through that. And they know what I'm talking about. and I see it every day in my practice. So let's not make any mistake about this. It's not just a 60,000-foot look at a system that's not functioning and not working anymore. This is about people's lives. And if we don't do something about this, we will continue to have people die in this country that should not die. They'll have premature deaths they should not have. So we need to put away, as we did in the commission, some of the baggage we bring into these rooms, some of the turf we come in to protect. We need to think about doing the right thing. This is not going to be, I believe, a partisan issue. I think it's bigger than that. And I'm hoping that it won't be a situation where it becomes political between different groups. I think we need to set that aside also. At the same time, we can't escape certain realities. The United States spends 50% more per person than any other country in the world in healthcare. 50% more. We rank 30th in life expectancy. We rank 30th in child mortality. We can go on and on with those figures. We have a system that does not work and will not work. We can choose here to talk and talk and talk and not come to resolution over the next 3 or 4 months. And if we do that, the system in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years will fail. And when it fails, we'll be looking at a ballot measure, I believe. Whether ballot measure 5 or 11 or 37, we'll be looking at a ballot measure. And the legislatures will be looking at ourselves saying we've failed our responsibility to Oregonians again. I'm saying at this point we are not going to fail our responsibility. We're going to deal with this problem. We'll overcome our fears and our worries about changing the system dramatically. And we'll come up with a plan that actually works. It's within our grasp. We can do this. We have to have some courage to do it and some boldness. And I'm going to call on every member of this panel to help us do that. Having said that, I want to make a few comments about where we're going tonight, Ben, just for a second. We have 4 or 5 different plans and thoughts and groups coming before us in the next few months. Tonight we're going to be looking primarily at what the commission for the Senate did over the last 16 months. That does not mean that's the preeminent decision. We happen to have that available and ready to roll right now. We don't have the Archimedes program ready to present tonight. We'll be doing that later. We don't have the Health Policy Commission ready to go. We'll have that later too. We're not ruling anything out of those plans. We're going to look at all of them carefully and listen to them carefully. So people understand that whatever you hear about any particular plan is not the final answer. We're going to deal with those as we go along over the next 30 days, next 60 days, next 90 days. My hope is that somewhere in mid-April, we'll have formulated the plan that we want to have lead this committee. Ben, it's yours.
Or to say that all a different way, if this country's smart enough to put a man on the moon and invent baseball, how come we haven't figured out what 36 other industrialized countries have figured out? And that's how to provide effective, safe, and affordable health care to all their citizens. Organizational meeting is closed. We will open the information meeting on Special Senate Committee on Health Care Reform. And we are proud to call first of the dais, John O'Connell from OHSU, just to briefly discuss some of the major cost drivers in healthcare and what some of his participation in the Senate Commission.
Thank you. For the record, I'm John McConnell from Oregon Health and Science University. I'm a health economist there. I'm going to talk about some cost drivers. I do want to note that Representative Greenlick said that if he heard me talk about these issues again, that the pain would be roughly equivalent to having his knees broken. So I apologize to those who've heard some of this before. I understand that's
okay. And Tylenol doesn't help. Tylenol doesn't help.
Tylenol doesn't help. Is it preferable to go through the presentation and take questions afterwards?
Yeah. Okay. Very good.
So the challenge of healthcare costs, we're familiar with these, but as a refresher, healthcare has become increasingly expensive over the years. In 1962, it accounted for about 5% of our GDP. By 2004, it was up to 16%. Some predictions have us close to 20% by 2010, so that would be one out of every $5. The consequences we are also aware of. This makes it difficult for businesses, for Oregon businesses, because the premiums go up at a rate that's often faster than wage productivity. Employees see that those premiums are expensive and are often less likely to buy the insurance, even if it's offered by their employer. The state feels the pinch because Medicaid expenditures are going up at a rate that's faster than the growth in tax revenues. And for the uninsured, this means that insurance, if some of them are sort of on the edge of being able to afford to buy insurance, then it's becoming more and more expensive, and so it's adding to the rolls of uninsured out in the state. The theme of this talk, something that I want to talk about, is not just why costs are high, but to focus on the reasons that they'll get higher. And economists have sort of looked at this issue and come to a consensus over the last 10 to 15 years, and the sort of consensus is that there are a lot of little reasons why costs go up, but one big one. And that big one is technological change. And what I mean by technological change is new drugs, new procedures, new devices, all sorts of things that generally add to the quality of life and quality of healthcare and extend life. But they all increase the total cost of healthcare. And so you can imagine in 1956, if you had heart disease, that the prognosis there was roughly death. Now there are a lot of procedures that are expensive, that cost $40,000 for a CABG or something like that, but they can buy 5 or 10 years of very high-quality life. And so this is something that as a society we've been willing to do, but it's been raising the cost of care over time. If you look ahead and sort of look at people who are developing these things, you see a lot of the same that's going to be coming down the pike. There are a lot of imaging novelties that are coming out with MRIs, ability to sort of target areas for disease, a lot of personalized medicine breakthroughs, some of those happening up at OHSU. A lot of talk about unraveling the human genome. We know that that's been done. We haven't seen sort of the medicine come out of that, but we can expect that in the next 5 to 10 years we'll start to see more action on that front. And then general tinkering with the human lifespan, which is that human lifespans are getting longer and longer and longer, and so that means that there are new ways to do that, but also a lot of diseases that sort of that older people have as the lifespan gets longer, and so that adds to the cost of care. Some people have said that there's no accountability in the system, and this is a chart that was developed by Bob Galvin, who is the primary purchaser for healthcare at General Electric, so he deals with these issues quite a bit. And his story here is that if you start at the top in terms of drug and device, that sort of the people there and the corporations there, that, you know, they see their job as innovation. They're trying to help people. They're trying to come up with new things that are going to provide a better quality of life. And then it's really up to somebody else, primarily the doctors, to control the use and decide when it's appropriate. Looking at the physicians or the clinicians, on a one-on-one basis, they're saying, you know, my job is doing everything I can to help my patient. I shouldn't be asked not to use certain types of care. For the consumer or the patient, when they're in a sort of a situation or state where they're ill, I think it's very natural for them to look to the most advanced technology or anything that's out there that can buy them an extra year of life. And usually insurance doesn't cover that, and so they want the best that they can get. Coming over to the FDA, this is sort of the one regulatory body that's there that's saying yes or no about what can be released into the market. They have one hurdle, and that's only for safety, and they don't say anything about cost effectiveness. And so the general trend is to introduce new devices, and these sort of spread out, and often they spread at a rate that sort of looking back on it is perhaps too wide and adopted too quickly. Coming over to the payers, these are the health plans. I think they very much want to pay for the right things, but they feel that for most of these, there's no data, and that a lot of times it's hard for them to say no, that they're under a lot of pressure to provide coverage and less pressure to sort of deny treatment for certain types of new technologies that are coming out. All this sort of wraps up, and what you have is that technology is adopted on a widespread basis and that costs tend to go up. This is projected per capita spending on healthcare. We're looking at a rate of about 6 or 7% in terms of real dollars over time. I think it's important to think dynamically here and to think about cost growth and not just why costs are high. Estimates are sort of rough estimates, but generally the feeling is that spending related to new technology accounts for about 50% to 75% of increases in spending. And I think this, and I think for a lot of economists, the sense is that it really compels us to think dynamically and not to think just why our costs are high today. You might think about this in terms of purchasing a house, that if I told you to go out and buy a cheap house, there are lots of things you could do to sort of, you know, if you had your housing needs, you could think about whether or not you needed a fireplace or how many car garages you wanted to have. Those are different parameters than if I asked you to go out and find a house that was going to appreciate at a high rate. If you wanted to find a house that wanted to appreciate at a high rate, you would sort of look at location and think about population growth and things like that. And so I think that there are differences between what makes healthcare expensive today and what is making it go up in the future. And I think it's very important to understand that trend, because that is what is going to be driving the cost in the future. A lot of reform and sort of issues around healthcare savings unfortunately focus on things that are one-time only savings. And to sort of give you an idea of why this I think these are important, but why this doesn't solve the problem is to imagine this scenario. We could imagine a reform. This could be one of many things that would lead to one-time decrease in the cost of healthcare of 15%, but did nothing to change the trend in healthcare. And so what this would look like is this. You get, we start in 2006, we get a big cut, nice savings there, but the trend tends to go up, and what that means is that puts us right back where we started within 3 years. And so what you would really like is something that is cutting those costs but also dealing with the trend, and that's going to sort of keep us flatter over time. So the implication for policy here is that if health reform is going to be sustainable, if we're going to be able to pay for these things in the future, we have to address the cost growth, because the cost trend is up. And if you want to be able to pay for it in the future, that the cost growth issue must be addressed. Without that, then the savings that you're getting from any sorts of health reform are eroded within a year or two or three or four. And I think this is a big problem for Massachusetts, and one that they frankly have not confronted yet. So that's sort of some discussion around cost growth, which I think is a very important issue. I want to sort of shift gears a little bit and cover a few other things that are informational. Primarily, I'll talk about cost shifting. I want to talk about some supply and demand side incentives on the insurance side, and then talk about Oregon spending in terms of providing some sort of informational picture about Oregon. So first, let's talk about uncompensated care and cost shifting. This is sort of based on some preliminary work that I'm doing on uncompensated care in Oregon. Uncompensated care, I'm looking at hospitals, and hospitals, when patients come in and can't pay, hospitals write that off either as bad debt or charity care. We've gathered the financial records and sort of looked at this and calculated, let me back up. That uncompensated care is often reported in terms of charges, and charges are not directly translatable in terms of costs. So we've taken the hospital financial data, developed some cost-to-charge ratios to understand what the true cost of uncompensated care is. And it's really gone up over the last few years. In 2004, this is the most recent year that we did it, that I estimate the total Oregon hospital uncompensated care to be $299 million. Based on some other work that other researchers have done to sort of estimate total uncompensated care outside of the hospital, so that's physicians and clinics, my estimate for Oregon is about $425 million in 2004. Again, this has been going up since 2004. That works out, if you look at sort of that on a per-person basis or a person with private insurance, that works out to be roughly 9% of the Oregon family premium in 2004. So that's a considerable amount. The cost shifting, I think, is real. There's been some debate sort of in academics about whether or not this can happen, but in talking to providers in Oregon, health plans and providers, there's a real sense that, yes, it does happen, that what happens is that when there's uncompensated care, that health plans acknowledge that, and that's sort of built into the negotiated rates for the following year. And so, as a result, the cost of the uncompensated care gets folded into private premiums. This sort of works like an inefficient or hidden tax. It's folded into our premiums. We don't really see it. It's sort of an agreement to support catastrophic care, those patients who come in through emergency departments and are then hospitalized, to pay for that through the private premiums rather than sort of covering them through an explicit tax that would then provide coverage and pay for something like preventive care that would hopefully keep them out of the hospital. It does add to the increasing cost of commercial premiums and probably is a partial factor in some of the erosion of employer-sponsored health insurance that we have seen in Oregon. Based on my numbers, I was surprised at how large these are. I think the magnitude of uncompensated in Oregon is large, and I think that's suggests that there are some substantial savings possible to employers and employees from programs that do cover the uninsured. I also want to talk about some market insurance responses, because I think these are important to think in the context of public policy as well. I'll break these down into sort of supply and demand incentives and insurance. What we saw sort of in, throughout the 1990s was a real focus on supply side incentives. This was a these were managed care models that were really focused on the provider and not as much on the patient. We saw some pretty impressive savings there. In fact, real or sort of inflation adjusted healthcare spending was relatively flat for much of the 1990s, and that's a trend that we have not seen going all the way back to the Great Depression. This was not a popular scheme, however, and there were a lot of complaints from providers and patients, and we've seen a real pushback here. However, looking at the literature, there are no observed quality or outcome problems in the aggregate. Obviously, some anecdotal stories here, but no sort of large-scale studies that show problems with quality associated with managed care methods. It's sort of interesting if you think about managed care. I think, you know, a lot of us think about utilization review and tools to sort of deny patients access and things like that. And you might think that that is where the savings come, but the research shows that the real savings from managed care came not from those tools, but from narrow networks and pretty strict discounting from providers. And so this is really about large negotiations from the providers that the health plans captured and then passed on to the consumer. So I think that's important to keep in mind when we're thinking about what the tools are that gave us those flat savings. As I said, we saw a real consumer backlash and a price rebound, so prices have gone up since managed care sort of backed off of some of those tools. The focus now is on the demand side. This is really on the patient, and is often has a number of names, but often referred to consumer-driven healthcare. And this primarily means higher deductibles, more cost sharing, and things like health savings accounts. Hopefully, coupled with better transparency and some sort of information technology that will allow patients to make better choices. This focus is sort of has a good founding in some evidence from the Rand Health Insurance Experiment, which is a large-scale experiment in the 1970s where they randomized patients to different cost-sharing plans. And they saw across the board that cost-sharing mattered. And as cost-sharing went up, that patient utilization and expenses went down. They also saw that for most patients that there were no, as in managed care, no real adverse outcomes associated with any of the cost savings. There's a slightly more complex story there with a certain group of patients, those who were both poor and sick. But in general, the average patient didn't have any adverse outcomes associated with that. Because of the recent interest in this, there have been some simulation estimates to sort of understand what the savings would be if we shifted many people into health savings accounts. And the sort of the most recent ones published a few months ago suggest that moving everybody into high deductible plans with health savings accounts type tax deductible setup would save about 3% to 8% of healthcare costs, which is substantial. I think looking at both of these and thinking about them in terms of the big picture, the implications are that there are some definite roles for both supply side and demand side methods for reducing costs without adverse outcomes for the average patient. As I said before, there are some caveats for the sick and poor, but average patients, I think, do pretty well under these mechanisms. Nonetheless, there are some important shortcomings, and I think this is where public policy has a role. Neither of these have a sort of a strong method for covering the uninsured. Also, neither of them, both of them are sort of one-time savings. They've been able to show important savings in a one-time only sense, but neither of them, there's no evidence that either of them can really constrain cost growth. And since that's the focus of my talk and one that economists are really concerned about, that's important to keep in mind. Any savings are worthwhile. Any savings will sort of reduce the cost over time, but if you really want to focus on cost growth, there's not good evidence that either the managed care methods or the cost-sharing methods are really going to curb the growth trend. I want to shift and talk a little bit about Oregon spending in the national context. This is primarily sort of informational, so you can see where Oregon stands. We're a pretty average state in terms of premiums. These are commercial premiums, and you can see for the single premiums that Oregon is right at the national average. For the family premium, we're just a little bit under. The rate of cost growth in Oregon has also been very close to the national average. And this sort of gives you some idea of where we're spending our money. I present this because sometimes people sort of lose track of where a lot of the dollars go. About two-thirds of them are for hospital and physician services, and Oregon is pretty close to the national average. We're a little bit under on hospital, but nothing dramatic. Otherwise, we compare pretty well to other national averages. There are obviously a lot of cost issues in terms of health care, and I've not covered all of them. That would be a long talk here, and I don't want to put Mitch through any other undue pain. I think all of these are very important, and each one of them can be folded into different types of health policy. But I think economists, when you sort of look at their main concern, I think they feel that the long-term problem is really confronting rising costs from new technology. I think their feeling is that there's a strong role for policy here and that it should not be anti-technology because they're, on average, these new technologies and new devices really have a lot to add. Ideally, you know, it would be nice if we could sort of pay for technology at a slower rate, not have it adopted en masse every new thing that comes out, and also reduce some inappropriate new technology that comes out. I think we need to acknowledge attention to the trade-offs here, that scientific advances have been generally improving the quality and length of life, but that these expensive new things are raising the cost of health care, and that means that there are more uninsured and that health insurance is more expensive. So I'll close here. When I look at the literature, I read journals that are from health care, health policy, health economics, and also just general economics. And this is a problem. This issue of cost growth is one that is sort of captured all sorts of scholars. When you read these, and this sort of been happening for 10 years, you find that one word comes up again and again and again, and that word, and that's sort of written by people from Harvard or North Carolina or Yale or Stanford or all over the country in all sorts of journals, they always mention Oregon. And sort of their story goes, you know, this is the problem, and this is my perspective on the long-term growth in technology, and this is why I think it's a problem, and this is where I think it's going to go. We don't know what's going to happen. The only state that's tried anything like this is Oregon. And this is what happened in Oregon. They did this with their Medicaid programs, very interesting experiment, but we don't see any other states trying it, but Oregon's the one that stands out. So Oregon really is a model for the country on this, and I think that that's important to keep in mind because of our past history, but also because these issues, Oregon is the only state that's really tried this. And there are a lot of people out in the state, people in this room, but also sort of just the general providers that have experience with this, and I think we're well ahead of the country in terms of thinking about these issues, and it's a real strength that Oregon has in terms of really confronting some of the major issues for health reform. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Now, for all the committee members that think you have seen this before, I have it on good authority, and that the reason you don't have the slide presentation at your desk is that John just finished fine-tuning this again for the upteenth time. So I am confident we will be provided the paper version of this, which was very informative, as always. Any questions for John?
Thank you. The cost shift is it's an intriguing concept that has a lot more parts to it than you've included. And I'm, you know, the counties, we just had a meeting earlier, Ways and Means Committee, and we have people from the county saying we're losing timber receipts. That's going to translate into cuts. Social services, addiction, all of the kinds of things that keep people out of the system. And that is a huge cost shift. And I guess what I'm hoping is that we can address some of the things that we have to do. I guess you can call it preventative, but that, I don't like that term because it implies, you know, doing a lot of exercises and so on. I'm talking about preventative in terms of treatment to keep people out of the emergency room, to keep them out of the jails and so on and so forth. So that's another aspect of the cost shift. And I think, I don't know how we address that, but we certainly have to address it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the numbers that I presented here are sort of a narrow slice based on available data, but I think that there are there's a lot of stories like the ones that you've told about sort of losing coverage in one area and somebody else picking up the bill.
Well, the alcohol, drug, mental health patient dabbles in alcohol, drugs, and has a mental health condition, and if we cut treatment, outpatient treatment for that person, they are going to end up costing us a lot of money. And that's got to be the basis of whatever system we come up with. We have to do that part of it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, because at the beginning when you talked about in 1962, healthcare was 5% of GDP, and we all know what happened in 64. I mean, clearly, in my perspective, government involvement in healthcare has been an inflator on a large scale, which is something we hopefully develop plans to address. But I guess my question was relative to the technology and the science of the time. Was there, when we had the increase in the cost relative to GDP, was there a corresponding increase in quality? I mean, it's a relative measure, I understand that, because technology, because of everything. I mean, and I would measure that by access and other various factors. And it'd be interesting to find out. There was a perceived crisis, and so the Feds created two programs, and were they at that point in time solutions in search of a problem, or was it real?
Well, I think there's been some very good studies by David Cutler at Harvard, who's looked at that exact question and tried to understand sort of, are these new technologies worth it? And his answer is yes for most of them, and he's focused a lot on cardiac care and found there that these procedures that are very expensive, that sort of the kind of, when you put one of these economic value of life numbers on sort of what you save, that he was coming up with a number, sort of return on your investment of 7-1 or something like that. So for a lot of them, the return has been good, and then quality has been good, and the sort of the average technology that comes out provides some quality and provides some better life. I think the concern is sort of that, you know, we know that there's a lot of waste out there, and that there's a lot of inefficiently used technologies, and that is really sort of adding to the cost. And so the question is, how do you pull back on some of those without hurting the quality that we know is in there with a lot of the new technologies and procedures? I think you started, I thought you were going to ask a question about Medicare. I think that, you know...
Well, I kind of was.
Okay. So when Medicare expanded, I mean, I think that those things are very tightly intertwined, because basically what Medicare said was, we're going to pay for these things. And so it provided a strong incentive to come up with new drugs and technologies. And it's very closely linked to this issue that I've been talking about. It's sort of, you know, there wouldn't be all of these new things coming out if we didn't know that that the government and sort of private insurers were following government's lead to pay for them. The problem is that Medicare has not been very good about saying no for some of these, and we know that there are things out there that are not cost effective, that, you know, that we have data on, that are still being covered.
Mitch?
Thank you, sir. John, both the Senate Commission report and the Oregon Health Policy Commission report have in it, buried in it somewhere, the notion that in order for this to succeed, we need to change the healthcare system. And I was intrigued with the reminder that most of the managed care savings are one-time savings. And we do have a sense that there was managed care and there was managed care. Mm-hmm. There, we see many of the so-called managed care organizations, even inside OHP, working hard to innovate. And when you get all the physicians and all the payers and everybody else together, you can create ways, at least on a mini basis, to change the healthcare system. You sense there is some way to use some kind of managed care, and maybe not the managed care of the 80s and early 90s, to manage care?
Yeah, I do, and I that's sort of. I think it's a good question. I'm not going to be able to give justice to that, but I think that there's a lot of very nice things happening within the fully capitated health plans within OHP. And I think other types of managed care, you know, people are taking a closer look at it. The sort of the Kaiser prepaid model, you know, people are sort of coming back and looking at that and sort of trying to understand why that's providing more integrated care. But it's clearly not for everybody, and it's, you know, it's sort of the tension is sort of, how do you get some of the benefit without having some of the consumer and physician issues that were around that. So, you know, I think that, and some people have suggested that maybe what you need is sort of more cost sharing and more managed care, and the cost sharing is going to help the patients understand why they're being asked not to do X, Y, and Z, because they can see it out of their pocket, whereas sort of the managed care side will be able to sort of manage some of those, you know, the big costs, the disease management and things like that, that sort of aren't so applicable to some of the higher cost sharing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I noticed one of your slides that it's probably, maybe I read it wrong, but I think it's probably a misprint. You just put these slides together, but it triggered my mind. And said, how is Oregon doing the national health care contest? Not content. And, but, you know, actually, I think you might put the right word in there. So it triggered my thoughts about Medicare and about our health care system. And, you know, when we look at other industrialized countries, the ratio of specialty care to primary care is roughly 70% primary care, 30% specialty care. In our country, it's actually the opposite of that. We're the only country in the world that has more specialists than primary care physicians. And on a personal basis, over the Christmas holidays, I was asked to fill in for a hospice group. We're shorthanded and took two shifts from 7 o'clock at night to 7 o'clock in the morning, which a guy my age probably should not be doing. It may be dangerous for me and the patients. But I had about 15 admissions during that time. And in process of admitting those patients, taking care of them, most of whom were Medicare patients, I kind of wore two hats. One, the physician who was doing everything I could for the patient, and also the hat of the senator thinking, how many of these patients, if they'd had a primary care home, preventative care, managed with the chronic disease processes, maybe weren't smoking, maybe gotten their weight down, maybe had a team approach to healthcare, how many of those 15 would have actually been admitted? Each of those admissions is probably $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 by the time they get there for 3 or 4 days, get stabilized, and back out. I could identify 3 out of the 15 that I thought were legitimate admissions to the hospital would have happened under any conditions, the other 12 or not. Cost to the system on that situation is huge. I also noted that there were no Medicaid patients admitted during those two shifts, a Friday night and a Saturday night. About half our county now is under managed care through the FCHIPS. The other half is fee-for-service. Those both struck me. And I got to thinking about one slide I didn't see here, and that's where I'm going to ask you to comment. That slide showed the relative payments under Medicare for various states, where Oregon ranks against states like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, which are bringing out programs, which are frankly pretty easy to bring out when you're a high Medicare reimbursed state. But it also showed the results of putting more money into the Medicare system, and there was a point there where the outcomes didn't match what was put in, and the outcomes actually started to get worse, if I remember right. Could you comment on that for me?
Yeah, I'll answer all of your questions in one slide. This is
that's good, John.
Okay.
Can you answer it in a shorter period than he asked the question?
Yeah, I think that the
you have to say agree with the guy. You
know. Well, so here, this is a when I talk to economists outside of healthcare, they're amazed that you can have an industry where you spend more and you get worse output. They just think that there's something wrong with your graph. But here's the graph, this happens in all sorts of analyses. When you look at for Medicare, they do a lot of these type of studies where they look at spending and quality. And as spending goes up, that quality goes down. And this is sort of I just said earlier that over time that these new technologies have added quality, but sort of looking and cross sectionally, that we know that if we spend more and we have areas where we've got a lot of specialists doing a lot of procedures, touching the patient quite a bit, that outcomes are actually worse. And I think this slide speaks to it. Fortunately, Oregon is not doing too poorly there, but I think that Oregon is not getting its fair share from Medicare in terms of what it gets reimbursed, and I also think that Medicare reimbursement, there are a lot of problems with it generally that if they were fixed would sort of help the system. I mean, you know, what you're talking about there, there's a very successful sort of pilot program at OHSU that began at Utah that looks at generalist care managers. These are nurse RNs that have a little bit of additional training to take care of a patient who has multiple diseases. And the outcomes from that are fantastic, but Medicare does not reimburse for that. And so these are things that are paid for by the physician to free up time, and then they make their money back by having other patients come in. And it seems, you know, this is something where you step back and you say, well, why don't you let them bill for this care manager and let them take care of all these patients and help them educate themselves, and the outcomes would be a lot better. But that has to happen. That is yet to happen.
Thank you, John. That is really a key slide and a key element in our problem. And I hope people keep that in mind. Our system is upside down. As Rick Wopat told us, whenever it means you get what you pay for, but not in this system. Thank you.
Thank you.
John. Thank you so very much. Now, I noticed that the lights are up. We actually are joined by a number of our Senate Commission members, not Rick Lopat. So I'd like to take this opportunity to invite up Bruce Goldberg, Jan Buffa, Susan King, Mike Becker, and Mary Beth. I saw you sneaking in late, girl. If you'd just like to come up and share some general thoughts as to what you thought the process, maybe where the federal government's going, you know, some observations. And don't feel obligated, but more than anything else, I just want to recognize all of your hard work and dedicated efforts to getting us as far as we've gotten. Don't be bashful.
Hi, Mike.
Yeah, really.
Mike, come on up.
Don't hesitate to call. Bashful.
We'll be the second string. unless you just like us to jump in.
Yeah, why change? There were certain consistents.
Mr. Co-Chair, you have to keep these people under control.
Yeah,
it took us 16 months of doing this, and we still have
there were certain constants in the commission work, and as many of you are in the audience, we're also in attendance at many, if not all, of the committee members. One of them was, I'll be kind, Mary Beth.
Okay, I can't leave you.
Why don't we just take it, Mike, Susan, Bruce?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I work in the area of public policy and community affairs. I've handed to the committee a brief written statement that I prepared. I'd like to read just part of it to the committee today. I really appreciate the opportunity to work with the commission over the past 12 months, I think it was, or 9 or 12 months, and this is the statement I'd like to make today. The current health care system is broken and in need of major structural change. All stakeholders, patients, employers, physicians, hospitals, and health plans have contributed to the dysfunctional health care system we have today. For this reason, Regents continues to be an active participant in all of Oregon's major reform efforts and work groups. Those include Archimedes Movement, the Oregon Business Council, process, the Oregon Health Policy Commission, and the Senate Commission on Healthcare Access and Affordability. All of these efforts focus on the need for universal access to care. Getting everyone covered by health insurance is important and something that Regents absolutely supports. But it is not enough that the healthcare access be extended to include coverage for all uninsured. Real reform will only be accomplished when we create an affordable, sustainable healthcare system built on the foundation of patient-focused competition, consumer choice, and shared responsibility for health and wellness. For these reform efforts to work, we will need accountability, full transparency of provider quality and cost, and engagement of the patient and the physician in evidence-based healthcare decision-making. Regents strongly supports the need for collaboration among the many Oregon healthcare reform work groups. It is critical that these competing reform efforts be at the same table and engage in a collaborative process to define a single vision that will lead to a sustainable healthcare system. If we end up in a legislative free-for-all between the competing reform proposals, there's a real likelihood that we will have little or nothing to show for our efforts. We have before us an unprecedented opportunity, but we need to find the common ground that exists within all of these proposals and use that as the foundation for change. Working together, I believe we can transform healthcare into a functioning, sustainable marketplace where consumers and purchasers truly take charge. I have some specific comments in regard to the draft proposal, and I won't go into the specifics of that. I'll leave that for the written summary. But I do want to say that the proposal needs to be more explicit in addressing how this new healthcare system will be sustainable and how it will effectively control costs. To be sustainable, it must dramatically change the way in which each stakeholder, that is, patients, physicians, hospitals, employers, and health plans, interact with this healthcare system and how each stakeholder thinks about and uses these scarce healthcare resources. At the same time, we need to recognize the power of patient-focused competition, the power of market forces, and the power of consumer choice and shared responsibility as the primary tools in this new healthcare system. Compared to creating an all-controlling healthcare regulatory entity, that should not be the focus of these reform efforts. So with that, I think if we look at these specific changes that I've suggested here, these are the types of things that can help control cost. They are the types of things that support the presentation we saw from John McConnell, and they will make our new system sustainable. And with that, I look forward to working collaboratively with this commission, with the other stakeholders, on true health care reform for Oregon. Thank you.
As you have done throughout the entire commission, I very much appreciate that, Mike, and I cannot agree with you more, and I very much appreciate you mentioning, as I did in my opening remarks, the entities that are all working on this, our communities, Oregon Health Policy, one of the most significant things is that in Oregon, before us now, there are four very honestly conceived, forthright proposals that seek to address the solution. I don't think any of them have a monopoly on good ideas, and that's what this committee is charged with, is putting them together. Thanks for mentioning everybody.
Thank you, Senator.
You bet. Susan?
Thank you, Senator. Susan King, Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association. I also maintain a clinical practice in emergency nursing. First of all, tonight, I want to thank the co-chairs of the Senate Task Force for giving me the opportunity and the privilege to work with you and a group of pretty impressive folks to come forward with the beginning of a plan. I'm going to very much look forward to the next couple of months for us to refine the plan and take in other good ideas. Over the Christmas holiday, I had the unfortunate experience to have a once-in-six-year illness, and so I had a lot of time to do reading. And so what did I pick up but the Pepper Commission's 1990 report? Senator Bates is smiling. You'll find a lot of similarities between the discussions we've had over the last 18 months. I also picked up former President Richard Nixon's plan for health care reform that also had a lot of things in it that you would recognize. And then, of course, reviewed some of the documents from the 90s with respect to the proposal that President Clinton made. We don't have a lack of good ideas. My belief is we have a lack of will, and that I've really enjoyed the time with the co-chairs and with my peers on the Access Task Force, that maybe we're going to have the will now. And that's what I'm really here about, is to say, let's do something finally. In my clinical practice, I have an opportunity every single week, just as Senator Bates had when he did some work over the holidays. I have an opportunity every week to get a glimpse of just what's wrong with the healthcare system. I'm not going to spend any time tonight because there are a lot of people here and the hour is late. The last shift I worked, and I practice in Portland in a very large, very busy emergency department, 25% of the patients that I saw in that four-hour shift were really those people who needed to be in an emergency department. Those were the people with kidney stones or fractured hips or fractured limbs of one sort or the other. The other 75% were people who came there because they had no other way to get health care. They had put off dealing with relatively minor health care problems until they ended up being serious. A five-year-old with pneumonia, for example. They were people who had nobody to consult with to find out if they should go to an emergency department, and so they ended up there waiting 4 hours in some cases to just find out whether they should be there or not. And many of them, unfortunately, were people whose health behaviors or whose lifestyle behaviors contributed to them ending up in the emergency department. So I think the solutions to the system are everything about what's been presented so far, and they're all about some other specifics. I have some written comments that I'm going to leave with you as my sort of opening statement, if you will, but would really like to focus on a couple. I think it's safe to say that we all have come together realizing that we don't have a healthcare system. We have a disease intervention system primarily. In a previous practice, I worked with people with diabetes, and I watched as the healthcare insurance industry, no blame Mike, of course, would reimburse for frequent trips to the emergency department. I have a neighbor boy who's 14, diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 5. Even though his parents have very good health care coverage, he didn't get really adequate education. And really, diabetes is all about managing one's own illness. And the treatment for diabetes isn't about insulin or pumps or anything else. It's really about working as a partner with the patient to help them stay healthy. That same insurance product would provide coverage for frequent trips to the emergency department when his blood sugar was too high or too low, or essentially he was in crisis. And there's something very wrong with that picture. So I think the first thing that any plan that emerges out of this legislative session or the federal government needs to realize that we're not here about healthcare services, we should be here about health. The second issue is one that's often painful for many of us to talk about, and one that we've nibbled about a bit, and that is, in my view, the long-term sustainability of our healthcare system, whatever it turns out to be, is really going to be dependent on healthy behaviors on the part of the population. We can't ignore the fact that it doesn't matter how good the technology is. In many, many cases, we don't even need to use it because the patient didn't need to be there with that particular problem. That's going to depend on making pretty big societal changes, all of which are not going to be made here in this room during this legislative session. It's going to require that we make some shifts to turn this, what I call this battleship around. It's going to take a while. We're going to have to stop having junk food in the schools. We're going to have to invest in the, Senator Morissette, preventive programs that help people not smoke or help people not use one substance or the other. So we're going to have to be partners. The healthcare system is going to have to be partners, but 50% of the solution to this is healthy behaviors on the part of our population, and that certainly is not the case today, at least what I'm seeing in my practice. So the individual responsibility for healthcare choices, I think, is going to be critical. The third issue I'd like to raise is, although I think there's a growing interest on the part of the population and perhaps a growing support for changes, making significant changes in our healthcare system, ultimately the people who are going to tell us whether we've made a successful change or not are those of us who are currently enjoying health coverage, health services, and health benefits. There are some segments of the population, and we've discussed this at length, Medicare population, those who are very poor and can access free services, who get those services now. And they will certainly be part of the equation. But for those of us who think we have things pretty good, the success of a healthcare system is going to be dependent on us getting as good or better services and better outcomes in the future. So keeping the public with us is going to be dependent on us making very wise choices, but actually producing a system that makes people's lives as good or better as they currently are. I would be remiss in closing if I didn't mention that in order to achieve the healthcare service system that we want in the future, we're going to have to deal with the realities of workforce shortages. Senator Bates has talked about specialty care. Obviously, we're going to have to make different kinds of investments, and the proposal coming out of our task force certainly isn't going to completely solve this, but we're going to have to make different investments in different kind of providers and a variety of providers if we're going to offer the patient-focused team approach to the kind of healthcare services that we want. Other committees and other endeavors in this legislative session, for example, are going to deal with those, but we're going to have to recognize that in order to achieve the system we want, we're going to have to make some very different investments. And finally, I'd like to remind us that no matter what we do with the primary care system, which my organization certainly supports the concept of the primary care home, the medical care home, the health care home, whatever you want to call it, that partnership, that place that the partnership happens between the providers and the patient, whatever we do with that system, we can't ignore the system, the public health system, for example, that deals with disease surveillance, with disaster management, and with environmental controls that is really ultimately going to be as important to the health outcomes of our population as anything else. So we have a big job ahead of us. I congratulate you on getting us to this point, and I thank you again very sincerely for allowing me to be part of it. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Goldberg.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. Knowing there's a busy agenda tonight, I'll be really brief, and what I want to do is actually take a little bit of a different tact, which is I've been, along with you, very frustrated by all the problems in our healthcare system, and have been working with many of you for years in helping to solve them. And tonight what I want to do is actually talk about why I'm not going to talk about the problems which have been so clearly articulated, and instead talk about three reasons why I feel very, very optimistic tonight. And the three reasons are as follows. Number one, it's pretty clear that the path for taking care of all the problems that have been so well articulated with our healthcare system, that the path and the way to do that is through states. That's pretty clear. This isn't going to be solved nationally. The governor and I met with Secretary Mike Leavitt of Health and Human Services a couple of weeks ago to discuss with him the fact that the Healthy Kids Plan we hoped was coming his way, as well as a variety of other things to reform the healthcare system, and we wanted to make him aware that it was likely that we were serious here in Oregon about this and these issues would be coming his way, and we hoped he would support them. And he was pretty clear about indicating back that, number one, he understood that serious health care reform was going to come from the states, that it's already happening, he fully expected it, and that he would be giving those issues his full attention. The second reason I'm optimistic is because of the tremendous number of great ideas that have been emerging over the last year in this state. All of the efforts that have come forward from many of the folks mentioned tonight. So there's great ideas, and I think that the work of the interim committee has been fantastic. And then there's the third reason. And the third reason I feel optimistic is because of all of you. The road to getting this done actually goes through all of you who sit up there tonight, and I am confident that you'll see to it that the solutions need to happen. So I'm feeling good.
Thank you, Bruce. All right, Mary Beth, Jan, thanks for coming this evening. Both of you guys, come on up, and then...
We're just being polite and not pushing them out of the way. Come on, Dr. Wilpott.
And I would like to say, Mary Beth, of all the important things that Dr. Goldberg said, he indicated we're on a tight timeline and we have a busy agenda.
Nice, Senator.
Ooh, yes. So you'd like me to go last? Is that
we'd like you to go right now and be cogent and articulate.
As I always am. And for the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. We're a statewide coalitional organization that's been working to reform the healthcare system, but mostly focusing on putting the human face on Oregon's healthcare crisis and really looking at the cost issues around healthcare. I too, to echo Susan and Bruce and Mike, really found the Senate Commission work very illuminating. I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to bring together diverse and divergent groups of people and individuals who really are more in agreement than disagreement. And one of the things I would like to say to those elected officials, congratulations, Representative Cannon, Representative Maurer, when Mike mentioned the competing efforts, that I think it's very important that we all recognize that while there may be many great ideas out there, Archimedes Movement, the Health Policy Commission, and clearly the work that the Senate Commission on Healthcare Access and Affordability did, they are not competing. And I think that there are more similarities to those three major reforms than there are dissimilarities. And I think it's important as elected officials and elected leaders that we recognize that. I, too, have a statement that I will leave with you and not read Senator Westland in the interest of time. But I would like to quote you. And Senator Westland really did say it best when he said that healthcare is the crisis of our generation. And it really is true. This state has been the leader in healthcare policy in the past, and we are clearly poised to do that again this year. We have the work that you co-chairs did in putting together the commission, I think really lets the rest of your committee members as well as the full legislature really has a framework in which to work through the tough nitty-gritty, get to the details that Mike referenced, but really create the system that will achieve quality, affordable, and secure health care for all of us. And I thank you for the opportunity to serve with you and be your punching bag, and appreciate any opportunity that I can to work with you. And we are also are here to help make sure that we accomplish this in 2007. So thank you.
Way to go.
It was less than 5 minutes.
Yeah, and the full quote was, healthcare is a crisis of this generation. America will no longer remain America if we don't solve this. That was the full quote. So I'm,
you know me, a little cut and paste action.
Yeah, yeah.
What can I say?
A little dramatic, but.
For the record, my name is Jan Buffa. I have the fortune of working with 500 physicians in Marion and Polk County, representing Marion Polk Community Health Plan and a number of other companies, of which the physicians were instrumental in starting. I have no prepared comments for this evening and a board meeting that I need to attend in a bit, but I want to take this opportunity to thank those of you who are participating on this committee and who have taken a great amount of personal and other time to work on the Senate Access and Affordability Committee. But with that, I'm going to close and just, again, thank you for all your efforts. I am optimistic, and I'm going to turn it over to my esteemed peer here who has his prepared comments for you. Thank you.
This is the main show. But you can see, I mean, just from the impromptu remarks and prepared remarks of some of the commission members, I mean, this is why we've gotten as far as we've gotten. There's a lot of good people that have put a lot of good time in this. Dr. Wopat, take her away. What we're doing here, this is functionally a 30,000-foot overview of the commission recommendations and positions as far as we have gotten. And I want to kind of echo Mike Becker's comments with regard to, you know, this is still a work in progress, as are all the other major proposals. This is what we are. I mean, we are to facilitate those good ideas and come up with a product. It is no small task. We will do this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Wopat. I'm a family physician. I practice in Lebanon, Oregon. I live in Sotaville, Oregon, the heart of Senator Morissette's district.
The soul of
the soul. Of I don't think we need the lights down too much here. Otherwise, considering the time, I have some fear of what will happen with the audience. I do want to say, you know, as my day job is as a family physician and as vice president of community benefit for Samaritan Health Services, but I've been involved in health policy for over 20 years, had the honor of being on the first Health Services Commission with Senator Bates, and currently serve on the Oregon Health Policy Commission. In addition, I did get the opportunity to work on the Senate Interim Commission, and I'm not sure whether it's an honor or a punishment. I've been chosen to do the presentation. So with that, I do want to say one comment. I've heard a lot of stories tonight about the shortfalls of the system, and I think Senator Bates very well articulated, you know, his experience in the hospital. I do want to share one story which is a little different than that, and that's, you know, I work in a free clinic, and I see patients on a regular basis that, similar to what Senator Bates was talking about, who don't get their medication and can't, you know, end up in the hospital and so on. But in July of this year, there was a young man admitted to the hospital with diabetes who had no insurance. He got taken care of. He had about a $10,000 bill, which he couldn't pay. Went home. About a month later in August, ran out of insulin and chose to die at home. And as a medical examiner, I had an opportunity to examine this young man after he died. He's 38 years old. He chose not to go back to the emergency room, according to relatives, because of cost, and hoped that he could stick it out at home. So there's a large unseen cost for not providing health care for Oregonians, and I think those are the people that choose to avoid until they are in a condition that either it is highly expensive or they may not get care at all. That said, my job tonight is to go over some potential solutions, and this is the solution that we have to date, and I want to say that this is really a framework. This is not the finished house. This is a framework. There's a lot of work to be done on details, but I think there are three things that I consider important around universal health care, and the first is universality. The second is shared responsibility, and the third is accountability, and we'll talk about how those things come up through this plan. The first thing that the commission did was agree that incremental changes were not reasonable, that if we were going to fix this, comprehensive reform was required. Back up. The commission was not a small group. It was very robust group of senators, representatives, many of whom you've heard here tonight, representatives from business, insurance, several different business groups. Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson is a psychiatrist, did a wonderful job of speaking to the concerns around mental health that we've already heard about. Dr. Moorhead, emergency room physician, and so on and so forth. It was an excellent group, and the discussions were very, very robust, and I believe very open and honest. And I think Senator Bates and Westland said it at the beginning, we had to leave our cloaks at the door. We had to give up our special interests if we're going to find a solution to this. And I believe people did that in good faith. This is an overview of a model, and I'm not going to spend much time on the model itself. I'll come back to that in a minute. But the principles around this plan were to assure universal access to health care for all residents living in the state of Oregon. The plan would create a system for more effective use of existing health care dollars, and at the same time provide a framework for cost containment. And that would be done through a system of primary care and prevention. And Senator Morissette stepped out, but prevention is not just about exercise. It's about a lot of health services like cancer detection, and it's about treatment of the conditions like diabetes and heart disease, where failure to treat leads to avoidable high-cost complications. The system would create market competition between qualified accountable health plans, and I'll talk more about what that means in a moment. And it would also provide oversight on transparency and quality. What are the goals? The first goal, and I think most important, is universal coverage for all residents of Oregon to a defined set of essential health services. We will never solve the cost shift. We will never solve the cost escalation until we have everybody covered so that we can treat their conditions early and avoid potential avoidable costs. The gentleman who, the diabetic that I saw, was one of several that had been hospitalized in the last year because of this issue around insulin and medications. And at this point, we're providing those patients with free medications because we think it makes much better sense to give them medicine than it does to treat them in the emergency room. Until we have everybody who has universal access to insulin, it makes no sense to have universal access to the emergency room for their diabetic ketoacidosis. The second goal is to encourage primary care and prevention. And again, prevention is more than exercise and weight control and so on. The third is to create a sustainable system built on public-private partnerships. I think Senator Cruz alluded to the issue around big government earlier. I think there is a consensus that this is not cannot be a governmental program. It needs to be a state program that is run by the people of the state with governmental oversight to the benefit of the citizens of the state. Another goal is to devise a fair payment structure. And that's partly the part before. This has to be sustainable. It can't just, you know, be a flash in the pan. And in order to do that, we have to develop payment structures that are reasonable and that allow the system to function. And that doesn't mean more money for everybody. We've talked, you know, at our last meeting, we had folks come forward and say, well, it's a great idea as long as I get paid more. I think any solution that we have for this problem is going to involve compromises and may involve some redistribution, but it's really about how do we do better with the money that's there and how do we create a better system. Another goal is to improve quality and transparency, and obviously last but not least, reduce cost growth. We cannot continue to have the cost grow as they have over the last 40 years and be sustainable. I do believe that we have a tremendous ethical dilemma that will face us in the next 10 to 20 years as new medications and so on become available. But unless we create a framework within which to address those questions, we're never going to be able to solve it. So this is what I think is a great first step. The health fund pool I want to talk about for a minute. This is about shared accountability. This is about pooling revenue for health care. It's about taking money and putting it into a common pool, which allows for a sense of ownership by the state and a sense of shared accountability for all people living in the state. My judgment. That's my judgment. The hope of the health fund pool is by creating some uniform administrative policies that we can simplify financing and purchasing of health care within the state. And hopefully by simplification, reduce some of the administrative costs and administrative burdens and cut some of that cost out. The health fund pool would be overseen by the Oregon Health Fund Board, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment, but it would expand options to individuals, would improve consumer choice, create uniform benefit alternatives for employers and individuals for obtaining health care coverage, and I'll explain how that works here in a second. Financing would be broad-based and would pool funds from a variety of sources. It would include public funds where possible. It would require us getting Medicaid waivers, and I would hope at some point Medicare waivers to put money into this fund. It would include employer contributions and employee and individual contributions. And for those employers who chose to be part of this fund, this contribution would replace their premiums. And the hope would be that it would be less than their current premium structure and would allow them to have a more level playing field. The fund would also create the shared responsibility for financing health care for all. I think the real question that has to be answered is who is responsible for financing health care for people who can't afford it? And my belief is that is a shared responsibility of an affluent society, and I think that this pool creates that opportunity. Next, to talk about the Oregon Health Fund Board. The Oregon Health Fund Board would administer the health fund based on public-private partnerships, and members who were part of that board would be representative of the state of Oregon. Now, that's pretty vague, and it's intended to be vague. The idea behind this is it is not a governmental agency. It is an organization that may function and is, in reality, at the end of the day, accountable to the government because there will be governmental dollars involved. But it will be made up of a representative sample of people across the state, and I would assume that would include patients, payers, providers, employers. I could go on, but I think that it would include all, as many people, many sectors as possible in a functional way. Next, what are the responsibilities of that board? The first would be to set standards for accountable health plans. Accountable health plans is a new term. It's a term that I think reflects our concern about accountability, that any health plan that's part of this has to be accountable for the money it receives and the care that's provided by its providers. And we'll talk a little bit about how that would function in a moment. The board would establish actuarially sound capitation and premium rates. The premiums for the cost-sharing part for those who could afford it, and actuarial capitation rates for accountable health plans. It would ensure access to care for all cardholders. It would maintain an advanced directory registry. For those of us who are involved in healthcare, one of the frustrating things is there are many people in the state who have advanced directives or wishes regarding their end-of-life care. It's really hard to figure those out when a patient comes in who's in a coma or who's had a stroke or who's been in a car accident. One of the steps forward in this state 10 years ago was a statewide immunization registry. So when I see a child, I can check and see what immunizations they have. This is very similar. If I'm in the emergency room or I'm in the hospital and a patient comes in and I don't know what they want, I can go to this registry and see if they're on file with an advanced directive. And I think that this would be a great step forward in terms of coordination of end-of-life care. It doesn't say that people have to choose not to be resuscitated. It doesn't say anything. It just says we would like them to make some choices, and we would like to create a state-supported registry where providers could go to look for those directives. The Health Fund Board would ensure transparency of costs. It would provide public access to price comparisons. It would establish publicly reported quality measures for services as part of that accountability piece. And it would establish a service level for that basic benefit based on the prioritized list. So this is now that you can go back to our schematic here and see how the public funds flow into the health fund program, which is overseen by the Oregon Health Fund Board, which has contractual relationships with accountable health plans. Accountable health plans will have to meet quality and transparency standards set by the Health Fund Board, and in some ways these will be uniform so that all plans now will be asked to report the same data. As a physician right now, each health plan has different data requests or different reports to me. And this will really allow us to aggregate data and create a very powerful tool for both patients and providers and health plans to improve care. The accountable health plan must enroll any Oregon health card holder that applies. And that is a way to avoid any health plan from choosing only the well or skimming the, you know, avoiding the sick people, risk avoidance. Back up. Accountable health plans, I obviously skipped over this one. Any qualified health plan is eligible to be an accountable health plan. That what would be defined, the board would help define what that means. In the onset of the Oregon Health Plan, there were many community-based health plans that became providers and have been very successful in providing care and under the Oregon Health Plan. And at least in our mind, this would work the same way. If someone wanted to be an accountable health plan, they would have to meet certain standards. Those plans would contract with a health fund board to provide essential services, and they would compete for the cardholders. They would compete most likely on service, quality, safety, so on and so forth. And then we already talked about transparency and risk avoidance. The benefit package. The Oregon Health Card, and we've talked much about a health card, but I think a health card is an important symbol. It's part of what will say that you're part of this plan, and that card will allow any individual who has it to purchase essential services through any accountable health plan for coverage for 12 months. The essential services will be the same for all people covered under the Oregon Health Fund plan. It doesn't mean that there won't be some shared cost piece, and that people who can afford to pay will pay higher percent of their care than people who can't. So you would envision having a cutoff at some percent of federal poverty level below which people would not pay copays, but above which they would. But again, that's a detail. That's part of the. Curtains on the house and how we put it together to make it work. The benefits of the health fund program, it'll assure universal coverage. It will emphasize primary and preventive care to enhance health and reduce avoidable health care costs. It will eliminate cost shifting to the greatest extent possible. A coordinated care model will help contain costs. Now, managed care got a bad rap. When I talk about coordinated care is really about managing care. And it's what I call integrated care, where the care of complex patients is coordinated through a medical home or through one site. When the Y River Group did a research project across the United States, they found that one of the main complaints that patients had in the United States, and there were two. One was issues around coverage and cost, and the second one was around lack of coordination of care. Because of our current disintegrated system, there's a lack of coordination, and my belief is this system would help coordinate care and would help to contain costs. Portability of the plan is regardless of employer. The benefit, it would allow for utilization of the current provider and third-party payer systems. It would not eliminate the current system in any way, shape, or form. It would allow those systems to go on, but it would create incentives for changes that would improve quality, transparency, and outcomes. It would simplify and standardize rules and the quality, improve transparency related to quality, costs, and safety. Obviously, it's not going to be simple. There are many challenges. One of them will be securing federal waivers, but I think the point has been made already that the federal government, people in Washington, D.C. understand there's little energy there to do a comprehensive solution. My belief is that they're waiting for the states to come up with innovative solutions, and I believe that if we could show them something that would work, they would be ready to provide waivers. There will probably be some fear on the part of current stakeholders. I'm sure there will be fear that about what this might look like, but I think Franklin Delano Roosevelt said about fear. And then we've already talked about this a little bit, we don't have a solution necessarily, but how do you create incentives for individuals around their personal health behavior? How do we encourage people? How do we create disincentives if they don't take care of themselves? Another challenge that's not listed is sustainability. It has to be sustainable. Lastly, I like to end with quotes. I like this one. We are continually faced with a series of great opportunities, brilliantly disguised as insoluble problems. This problem, I really believe, is not insoluble. It is solvable. And it requires leadership, and I've seen that on the parts of the co-chairs and others across the state. It requires will on the part of the legislature, I think, to step up and provide a framework within which we can work. And it requires persistence. And I really do think we can do it. And with that, I am open to questions, and I appreciate your attention.
We appreciate you coming up and being here. No. Questions? Dr. Cannon. See, we're just going to start calling each other doctor, because by the end of this, I mean, we'll be qualified to practice medicine better than Bates. So.
I don't know about that.
First of all, sometimes.
Congratulations. Commission, this is it's extraordinary work that you have undertaken. I have just a question, a clarification. How do, under this proposal, how would we assure that we all get the benefits of universal coverage? And I say benefits because I'm wondering how you would ensure that a young, perhaps healthy, perhaps even affluent person signs up for one of these plans, and perhaps having to pay for it as well. There are a lot of people my age, for instance, who simply choose not to to purchase insurance.
Well, I think any solution is going to require a certain amount of mandate. And the vision is that all employers would be paying a certain percentage of their payroll, most likely, into this pool. And all employees would have some input into the pool as a requirement, similar to what you pay and I pay in Medicare taxes. The other is that there are a lot of people who may not be on a payroll, and the vision that I would have, again, and this is obviously up to the legislature and how this plays out, would be that proof of coverage would be required to get a Oregon state tax deduction. And if they didn't have it, that would be the stick. And I do believe that, you know, it would take some time, but there needs to be sticks and carrots if we're ever going to get there. And in regards to then everybody is in the show, so to speak. And once everybody's in the show, then you as an individual will have a relationship with a health plan. You will be required to do that, and I as a health plan will be required to show that we are making sure that you're getting your immunizations and your appropriate health care and so on and so forth as part of my accountability. And you may be a healthy young male or a healthy young female, but if I'm not doing the things that I'm supposed to be doing to reach out and bring you in to make sure you're getting them done, that will be reflected in my reports to the state and so on and so forth.
And
to the fund, I'm sorry.
Ben, I think part of this is a value statement that everyone has
a shared responsibility to participate. The value is, it's not okay for any individual, particularly if they have, in your example, you know, affluent, it's not okay for them to cost shift their medical cost to the rest of all of us. This is, we are actually not pioneering in this regard. Massachusetts, already did this. Required, legislated that every individual have insurance. So, that's kind of the philosophy, and I think Dr. Wopat answered the question very well. But what it really comes down to is that we're all in this together. And just because you're at the end of the boat that doesn't have the hole in it and, your feet aren't wet yet, doesn't mean the boat isn't sinking. And you have a responsibility to help keep that boat afloat as well.
Yeah.
Bill.
Okay, well, I'm thinking about public employee groups particularly because that's where I spent my life and negotiating contracts for school teachers and so on. And I understand that as time goes on, we're all going to be in the same kind of a program, but there will be an opportunity to buy up in a plan. So the school district will continue to put a certain amount of money in, the teachers would continue to put a certain amount of money in, and then if you want a better program, you buy up. Now, is this true for other insured groups? So we're not going to destroy everything. We're going to build on what's there. And that answers a question that I had before. Now, because we're dealing with negotiated contracts, so you can't just go to PEB or any union and say you're going to join. It has to be a easing into it. You can't break contract law. But it makes sense, though, that everybody continue to participate with the idea that there is a basic service. And I'm trying to figure out how it may, and I wasn't at all of the meetings, but, the most valuable source are the clinics, the clinics that are all over the place, and that's where a lot of people get their health care at clinics, the federally funded.
Thank you, John, very much.
So are there going to be, maybe this is a dumb question to ask at this point, but there will be a series of clinics that will continue to take care of people, right?
Well, I think just to answer two questions, and I think
I'll take number one if you want to take number two.
I'll take them both. You can have them. Just briefly, there will be an opportunity to buy up for people who want to buy up.
Yeah.
And it's just similar to education. I think we'll have a basic benefit. And if an employer wants to put more money in or an individual wants to put more money in to have a better benefit, they can do that. In regards to clinics, my expectation would be that any clinic that wants to play will be able to play. That whether they're federally qualified clinics or rural health clinics or individual clinics, there will be changes in the delivery system as you create different incentives. But I still think that everybody will have an opportunity based on the quality and service and of the care they provide.
Want to say something here?
Yes, thank you, Senator Westland. Senator Morissette, the other piece that I think is really important, this is not going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
And one of the pieces of the latest iteration of the Commission's plan does call for a creation of a task force that would have all of those entities that are currently dealing with health insurance, PEB being one of them, Department of Human Services, et cetera, to Department of Insurance, Division of Insurance, rather, DCBS, to come together. Thank you, Senator Chris. would come together for a couple of reasons. One, that I see. One, the redundancy issue, right? We do not want to just create another program. That is not the intent of the Commission's work, I don't believe. But to find out where those commonalities are. And the other thing, too, is to give people the opportunity to look at what this program would really be. It's one thing to say it in a philosophical way, but quite another for, retired union members, current union members, as as you're concerned about, to really look at what this package of benefits are, and then to be able to say, okay, this may not be everything, and it may or may not be, right? That's a decision that you all will have to make. But this is what the package is, and weigh that against what they currently have, and then be able to make that judgment and see that thing. And I think the issue, Senator Westland, about us all being in together, that's the other aspect that I think is really a growing trend amongst Oregonians, that we are not alone in this, A, and that if we're going to solve it, we need to solve it together and be all together in the same system.
I just want to say one other thing. I was very upset and concerned that PEB cut their wellness program, and I am very much in favor of the prevention and the wellness programs. I'm also concerned about the lack of, we have to have consistent treatment for drug, alcohol, mental health people. We can't let them wander around and end up in an emergency room. So there's a lot of outreach out there. And I just see a series of small clinics taking care of a lot of that. I mean, they're already there. A lot of them are. And if we can create the, you know, clinics where people have access and are eligible with their cards, people who otherwise wouldn't bother going to a doctor. So those are parts that I hope we can do.
Yeah, you get there, Bill?
What?
You give him an Oregon health card.
Gee, can I take this to the bank?
Not today.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Comments?
Well, just a comment. I wasn't going to say this, but I wanted to go back to what Representative Cannon was addressing. And I don't know if this will make any difference or help you, but with car insurance, we mandate car insurance for everybody. It's against the law. You don't have car insurance. And so I don't see a problem at all, because to me, mandating health insurance is actually even more important than mandating car insurance. So just another perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was gonna hold my water, and I've tried really hard to do that. It's not in my nature. But to Senator Mona Sanderson, I just point out, no, we don't mandate car insurance. We mandate car insurance only for those that have cars. So there is a distinction there.
Oh, but everyone has health.
I understand that.
Or needs help.
I guess, you know.
Or not.
Well, some say I don't, but then that's. there's a couple things that I think are key. Number one, that card you gave him isn't a bottomless pit of money, and that needs to be acknowledged. Susan King, I think, really touched on some important stuff. As far, and I'm not sure how we get there, and, you know, as who's responsible, and at some point in time, the people themselves have to be responsible, and that is a huge, huge hurdle to overcome. That is a cultural shift, and that is going to be significant, and as far as PEB or any other state entity, I think we should consider on the front end that if we're creating a system for Oregon and excluding government, where it ain't going to work. As we've talked about this, and part of what I would like to go to is, I think government should lead by example, and we should be the first one in the door. And it's a nice house. Some of the rooms are in the wrong place, Dr. Bates, but the curtains are looking nice. So
I'll take it as a compliment. Thank you.
Okay.
For those of you out there, you have no idea what a laudatory remark that is from Representative Cruz.
But with that, I'll save the rest for the next Monday meeting. Night.
There you go. Okay. Night.
Any other questions for our panel? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to briefly testify? We're going to have plenty of opportunity to do this as we get to know each other much better. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Jan. Look who's the last to leave the dais. Thank you, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mike.
So when are we going to meet again? Next week.
Tuesday.
This is ridiculous.
Tuesday is my understanding. Next week.
I don't want to announce anything from the dais that I don't have complete comprehension.
The president's changed the date.
We will
We'll get to you.
We have mechanisms for getting any date changes or time changes, so I don't want to announce
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair, I might suggest if that one down there, because there were a couple of folks from the House that weren't here, and if you want everybody here, that F might be a better room.
Or if your favorite room, Jeff, 50.
Or 50. But F is more conducive. 50 is your favorite room, Ben. Okay.
You know, I really want to appreciate and thank everyone for coming. There's a couple of things I want to say just quite briefly. And some of it's represented by the questions posed here tonight and some by the testimony. And a couple of guiding principles here. I mean, one is that we've got to understand the current system cannot be maintained. It's not sustainable. And to fix it, everybody's got to put some skin in the game. This, and we know that creates anxiety. I mean, it's fear of the unknown. That we're all human beings. That creates anxiety. That's very understandable. But at the end of the day, what this is all about is people and human beings and health. And it's not just about providing access for those that don't have it. It's also about lowering costs for those that do. If we can't lower costs, there's no reason to go there. I see J.L. Wilson sitting in the back, head of NFIB. We've had long conversations about this. And that's his first complaint, is health care costs for his employers, small employers, and those that want to provide health insurance but just can't afford it. Good corporate citizens, good business citizens that can't afford it.
I've offered to draft a bill to allow small employers to pool their interest, and I've never had any takers on that by small employers.
Well, Bill, the chair is speaking. So
that's another stop, Bill.
The other thing, I can make two guarantees. One is that these meetings will be shorter. And they will be longer. And I want to close in complimenting Mr. Becker and his first comment in his first paragraph is that we're all part of the problem. No one's an enemy here. No one's a bad guy. Patients, employers, physicians, hospitals, and health plans. He left one entity out of there. Government. Government has a very significant responsibility in, as to where we are today. And we've got to acknowledge that. In those words, we are adjourned. But that was before.